As she stared out the window into the bluish blackness of night after a day, she heard a huge overhead grinding sound, a big velvety pull of metal on metal, a rhythmic scrape. Gideon watched, paralyzed, as one of the very expensive shuttles fell hugely and silently over the landing platform. It dropped like a suicide and seemed to hang gray and shining in the air. Then it fell from sight. To its left, another. Further left, another. The scraping ceased. Skeletal feet pattered away. Gideon fell asleep. You're listening to Nunpod with Left Grief, Episode 8. Welcome to Canaan House.
Have again another lovely scenery setting full of delicious sensory language. You mentioned it last time where you were talking about the kind of like contrast that the initial brightness and whiteness and marblitude of Canaan House has on Gideon in her first impression, but then it's immediately followed by this language of like the greasiness of Gerber, because that's the language of that's, you know, what Gideon has been had need to describe so far in her life.
The comparison to Gerber is so interesting here, that this was something beautiful that's gone to seed, whereas the ninth was already unbeautiful and was now old and ruined to boot.
And immediately followed with a corpse and corpses putrefied. But like, we have some really good examples of corpses not putrefying, but in fact being like sustained by necromancy, which I believe is part of this language's play. So we have this, like, you know, this thanergy happening as corpses decay, but like actual full decomposition and putrefaction being prevented due to this necromancy. That's literally the ninth as this like extension of the empire and just hiding its secrets. Like it doesn't live. It's just being held together by this unsustainable life-sucking effort.
I have seen theories that this space was originally a luxury shopping mall.
Yeah, sure.
It is pretty easy to find examples of white, gold, and glass-ceilinged shopping mall atria.
Yeah. And like the other examples we have of this, like that come to mind with distinctive, significant amounts of glass is like the Gilded Age era of architecture in like the US, the East Coast US, and in some of Britain as well, where you have this opulence.
I think that the presence of wood is something that maybe moves away from repurposed shopping mall for me, but I appreciate this theory nonetheless.
Yeah, totally. And this is supposed to be like a very large place, and floors were made of wood implies multiple different rooms. So we're talking about a fairly extensive amount of wood flooring too.
It does seem like there's a mix of wood and marble flooring. There is a really beautiful illustration of the Canaan House atrium by illustrator Lauren Wendell that shows these sort of round wooden insets in this gold shot marble floor that I think is a really beautiful take on it.
Who do you think are in the portraits on the walls?
I imagine Jod and the Lictors.
Yeah, that seems probable.
I think a statue gets destroyed later, and I sort of wonder if it wasn't a statue of Kithareia that she needed to destroy.
Oh, that's fun. That's fun. Where are they in the space as this is happening?
Think it doesn't say. They're just sort of, they've been brought in, people who've been invited to sit. The ninth isn't sitting.
It doesn't give you really a sense of their space in relationship to each other.
No, it's not clear kind of how close they are to other people or how they're distributed in the space.
Just enough that they can see each other's reactions.
Yeah.
Yeah, take a look at the art that Han mentioned. If you imagine them at this distances, we're looking at, you know, the closest person to you being at approximately 20 feet. And the furthest being around 80. Does that sound right?
Yeah, I think some of the couches are closer, so you might be within 5 feet of another house couple, but You might also not.
Yeah, but it's generally, I think, within that range that you can read someone. See, really the only indication we have of like their orientation to each other.
Yeah. They can definitely read each other's actions, but you could very easily say something quietly to the person that you were with without anybody else picking up on it.
For sure. This comes to what is honestly one of my most often remembered scenes and passages in this in the, any of these books. And I can't tell you why exactly, but maybe it says something about me. But the way that it describes Gideon drinking tea for the first time and the novelty of the flavor, I think this to me is when I got really invested in Mir's writing.
Gideon has never had a hot drink and she lives in it so cold.
It's so cold. And like the idea, to me, the idea that she can think of what something grassy is a little bit harder to believe. Where I'm like, how would Gideon know what the fuck grass is? Like, explain that to me. It's like we're like making all these like large world building continuity jumps of conclusions, but I'm like, Mir, Gideon doesn't know what grass tastes like. No, I think this is incredibly tender memory of Gideon's. Like, this is a moment in that slows down for Gideon, and she's noticing herself, she's noticing other people, she's noticing how they react to this object. Like, it goes through like everybody in the room and their interaction to holding a fucking teacup. Like, this is so novel to Gideon. She's like, what is this? What am I supposed to be doing? You
She's not
know.
familiar with tea or hot drinks or the concept of china. She has maybe never had a ceramic cup in her hand before. She has,
Yeah.
like, every part of this experience is so foreign to her, and she doesn't know how to drink a hot drink safely.
She doesn't know how to drink a hot drink safely. And like, this is like cauterized taste buds. Like, you immediately know what that sensation is, where you're like, yeah, there's no feeling in my mouth for the next 6 hours.
She's taken a huge hot gulp of steaming tea, and now she's like, oh, this is what my mouth is now.
Gideon is probably tough, probably has a surprising relationship to pain. So we're also imagining our theoretical super Gideon here, who like a hot gulp of burning, boiling hot liquid, like Gideon gets off easy here because she's got necromantic superpowers. So like, good job, Gideon. But like, I can't be me. Like, my tea needs to be like very safe, very, very safe. Like, I love Gideon. I will not embody. I will not share. No.
Gideon sees the three priests, and even after being so dismissive of the idea of these, tottering old religious weirdos or whatever, she has such deep sympathy with them, and she thinks that it must be terrifically lonely to live here, just the three of them.
Yeah. I think this is a wonderful moment where like all people present are sharing in something equally, but Gideon really stops to notice the distinct differences between them.
She is such an empathetic person. She is immediately on meeting Dulcinea, she's like really there, present for the idea of Dulcinea's death at a young age. And now she meets the priests and she's like, oh my gosh, their life seems so hard. And it's like, babe, you literally get kicked down the stairs for a living.
Yeah, I think that's really sweet that you pull this from this, because all that I pull from this is, unless they were hiding a bunch more in a cupboard, and I'm like, they might be, they fucking might be.
Well, they are sort of cupboards themselves.
They are sort of cupboards themselves, but I think it's so fantastic that that's literally, we're talking about the same sentence, and I feel like this is Gideon. Like, this sentence really, really captures Gideon so fantastically, where it's both this like dark sense of humor, but also this sensitivity. Because like, the humor doesn't come from a distance, the humor comes from a closeness.
The priest is bloodstained because of Kithareia coughing up blood on him, right?
Yes, his made 1,000 years ago and preciously maintained perfect ritual belt that has never needed to be used until now. And can never be remade.
He's like feeling anxious about it.
And this is, I think, a really great moment to talk about the kind of legal rights that someone like Teacher and his peers, like the relationship to death and to who you are and what you are and what rights you have in life and in death is so different in this world. The fact that we're like referring to Teacher and his peers as cupboards, there's that real what was it, instrumentalization of the body. We're in the same moment both seeing that like tenderness and empathy and awareness and emotional complexity, while also this language of dehumanization and instrumentalization is used in the same breath.
In this paragraph, the narration notices Teacher was the only one of the three who seemed real. There's so much to that when we find out, how many ingredients went into Teacher versus the other priests.
Like I have so many questions about like the economy of that.
Yeah, who were they? Did they
Were they how?
consent?
So, we come back to the topic of like the extractive nature of necromancy. We have a spacefaring imperialistic culture. This is not a slow consumption culture and economy. We're having large scale projects. So it's not like this is some kind of normal rate of mortality. Like the kind of economic organization you would need to have to collect and orient these different amounts of souls and thanergy, like this is an entire economy. And to do so in a way that's like sustainable to normal mortality rates is like not conceivable with this world that we've been shown. These are like monumental, massive death events. Or they have some way of storing it. Like they're like just the ways in which like you'd need to be able to capture, store, contain, orient, and like transmute a group of souls. Like there's different metaphors you can use to think about that, but there has to be some way of identifying how that process, what it prioritizes.
And in world, it seems like that always happens right at the moment of death.
Yeah, so the idea that like that teacher is extraordinary, I think is one that like shows that okay, this resource of thanergy and happening at the moment of death, like it's not so devalued that people are completely distanced from what is essentially a massacre, right? Like it's like Gideon's existence, Harrow's existence, Teacher's existence all have to do with these kinds of organized state violence in this way that's like either they have a way of storing it or they are just like this just it is gut-wrenching to imagine the level of organized death that would have to be institutionalized
And I don't think they have a way of storing it. I think that the day Teacher was made, they killed all those people.
So this might be a reason, like, to circle it to Forever War, because then you have a very organizable process to which plan mass casualty events.
Maybe. Lab scientists don't like to leave the lab.
Lab scientists don't like to leave the lab. Okay.
Lab scientists really are characterized by bringing nature in rather than going out. I don't think that was a field project. I think they took however many, because it was what, like 160 or something for Teacher and then somewhat less for the others.
I don't remember exactly, but
I don't remember exactly, but I think they just took whoever they had on hand. Probably people that they had relationships with, people that they knew, people who had been lab assistants and servants and,
the impression that I get from the conversations and environments presented through the second book is some kind of science cult.
Yeah, very, very possible.
There are people there who are bought in to this story, and some and people who are there because it's the best option they've found, and they were coerced in a moment of vulnerable decision making. And I think we see examples of both of that.
Yeah. It's so interesting at this moment that nobody's talking to each other, given that we later learn that, the third and the second were going to each other's birthday parties, and the fifth were teaching the fourth. And, like there are all of these relationships, and the sixth and seventh obviously should be friends and aren't. But, like, it's interesting that what Gideon isn't telling us or isn't seeing is joyful reunion moments of, oh my gosh, I haven't seen you in so long. Big hugs. Everybody is really atomized and really shut down. It seems like everybody's really uncomfortable about what this moment is.
I wonder, like, if any of these people in their life have ever received communication from the Emperor.
I would guess not.
Because, like, now, like, have they been culturally prepared for something like this their whole lives? Like, is that why they are adepts, or are necromancers just common? Because it seems like necromancy is just common in the world.
Seems like it.
Would they have been able to conceive of this possibility? Was that something that has been part of their upbringing, or are they just like, what the complete fuck is happening?
I would guess more what the complete fuck is happening. It's never happened before. In 10,000 years, nobody has ever been called to become a lictor after the original lictors. So there isn't an example that I can think of that's far enough back, Like there, I'm trying to think of a cultural touchstone from 8,000 BCE. I don't know anything about 8,000 BCE. We get a second prayer, and Gideon learns that the ninth religion is very different from the religion shared by the other houses.
Which tells us that the dominant religion wasn't part of the propaganda that Gideon was reading.
Or not a major part, yeah. Which I guess it makes sense. I could see there being some references to religion in propaganda like that, but not reproduction of entire prayers.
Yeah, sure, totally. We have another big flag around Prostylosilus, but it's hidden with a bit of noise about Ianthe because it compares them. So just after the first section of prayer, the standardized one comes through and it's talking about how Gideon had never heard that piece. Prostylosilus and Ianthe opt out of reciting the prayer. Prostylosilus, for one reason, being that he's a hulking mass of man meat. But Ianthe's motivation, unclear. If I were to wager a guess at her motivation, I think it has to do with her relationship to authority. I think she wants power for herself, and she doesn't actually regard any authority beyond herself as anything but a source of power. She has no investment in the narrative and beliefs and values behind this prayer. She doesn't give a shit. And I just think she like cannot be bothered to pretend. She spends all of her time maintaining a certain illusion about who she is, and this is one she just couldn't give a fuck about.
Yeah, that makes sense. And we never really see her being impressed about God to any degree.
Not any degree. She is God to herself. She is God. There is no authority beyond above her own in her mind. And like, to the point, I think that like it's one of the things that I think like her and Mercy Morn have a bit of tension about is both of them have a similar kind of disdain towards Jod's authority. I think Mercy Morn's sick of his shit, but Ianthe, she sees herself as God.
Yeah, I think Mercy Morn is kind of torn between being, on some level, a true believer and, on the other hand, having a very human relationship with John, who annoys the shit out of her on a personal and political level.
And so I think one of the tensions between Mercy Morn and Ianthe is the fact that both of them have this disconnect with the authority in the situation, and they use it to work together at certain points, but they don't actually, they regularly have tension about the fact that their conclusions they come to about it are drastically different.
Yeah, their resistance against God comes from very different places and looks really different.
looks really different, and I think we're seeing the beginning of it, of Yancey, right here.
I don't think I ever noticed that moment before.
It's a funny thing to realize that like a certain tell is happening to two different characters, but for drastically different reasons, and they're like, we'll just group them together and see what the readers do.
What do you make of the expressions in reaction to the ninth prayer? Bewildered or blank or long suffering? I assume openly hostile is the eighth.
Yeah, I assume it's Silas. Long suffering.
I don't know who long suffering would be.
It's not Kithareya, but I think it's funny to imagine it being Kithareya.
That's exactly where my mind went as well. I think that's not the performance she's doing right now, but she is the longest suffering.
Yeah, absolutely. I could see Colm being long suffering.
Yeah.
Bewildered. Let's see.
The
Yeah,
teens.
I don't, it could be the teens, it could be Marta and Judith.
Yeah. I could also see Marta and Judith going blank. Protesilaus is very likely blank.
Yes, Rasselas is definitely very likely blank. Bewildered, I think bewildered is such an unmasked reaction. I think the teens are most likely. I don't think Abigail and Magnus are going to be bewildered by anything happening here. And I would also guess out of everyone here, Palamedes and Abigail are the most informed about what the fuck might happen here.
Yeah, I think Abigail probably knows a little bit about the ninth, given just her age. Like, she had the most opportunity to have discourse with people coming to and from the ninth versus some of the much younger people.
So yeah, Colm long suffering, teens bewildered, Judith, Marta, Proselyt, Silas blank,
Silas hostile.
Silas hostile. Palamedes, like, probably just registering it. He probably knows of it because he's a nerd and just decides that he has to know everything about everything because that's why him and Harrow should be best friends.
Yeah.
But I think, like, if we're talking about the priests having very sincere experiences, I think that this is another tender moment of like let's maybe as readers and observers of this experience they're having, give them like, this isn't making them smoochable, but it's making them whole.
The priest is in ecstasy about the preservation of the ninth, which, given what we learn about the fate of Anastasia and her cavalier, whose name I don't say, that's such a tender. They might have known them. They did know them. You know, they knew them.
Yeah, we're seeing real memories, 'cause like, we've talked about like how much of teacher's memories, identity, consciousness is his own. But like this is a real one. This is,
This does seem to answer our question of when was this prayer written? Because it seems like we've been told that the first house has basically been shut down for the last 9,000 years, and the priests are like, that is the song I hoped you'd play.
And it's interesting that the continuity is a marvelous thing. Like,
First of all, Tamsin Muir, how dare you?
say more, say more.
Continuity is not a quality I would say characterizes the experience of reading her books.
Sure. Yep. I mean, like Tamsin Muir's opinion about this may be expressed in Gideon's response to this, finding this kind of mentality insanely tedious. So maybe that's Tamsin Muir being like, you don't get continuity. None for you. None. It definitely feels like there's like ways of, exploring this world that are heart crimes. But then there's also these ways where it's like cozy and healing and like protective of these characters and like wanting good for them, because we're like, the book already did enough heart crimes to them.
It's lovely to see the contrast between the unfeeling, unthinking skeletons and these priests who do have these rich emotional lives. I don't know that that makes it more ethical that they exist. It might be worse.
I think it's worse. I think it's worse. If we're talking about necropolitics, I think Teacher is one of the clearest examples of just how far respect and rights for the soul and the life have dwindled, and how part of the economy that has become and normalized, and just like you're slotted into the machine somewhere.
Yeah, and John later draws a parallel between his own ascension and what Harrow's parents did, but Harrow and Teacher are also really similar kinds of creature.
That's really true. Yeah. Do you recall the method of construction that teacher is?
I don't. I just remember that they put a bunch of guys into a guy.
Yeah, that's all I remember too. What I wonder how much teacher knows about Harrow.
Yeah, if he can kind of like clock it.
Yeah, if he knows, if he like, 'cause I get the sense he knows what he is. Because he is very much comfortable in his role.
Is that why he's afraid of the facility?
Yeah, he's a part of this thing and it will eat him. I think he's one of the most earnest characters. There's a surprising amount of earnest characters in this book.
I mean, he's totally guileless.
Yeah.
He seems like he's not really trying to like keep anything a secret or hide anything. His job is not to share information, so he feels like he's keeping a bunch of secrets, but he has so much less in terms of like secret plots than so many of the characters. Everybody else is like manipulating and scheming and
Like his job is to be helpful. He wants, like he immediately is like, I'm here to serve all of you because you're here at the Emperor's invitation. Like you are guests of the Emperor and you're here for a reason, and I'm here to acknowledge that. And that's also true with Kithorea. His role hasn't really changed. His directive hasn't really changed. And it's interesting thinking of them as teachers. Peers aren't exactly going to give him, extensive, engaging conversation.
It seems like they don't have as rich a social
Yeah.
self. And he's so excited that there's people to talk to.
He's so excited that there's people to talk to. And I think maybe also part of that melancholy is understanding that this is a limited time thing. But while they're here, he's gonna try and make them feel welcome. I really enjoyed kind of figuring out what the keyring physical object itself was referring to because, Mir's tendency is to pick something that really existed and use that within the world, pulling in some of the meanings that it had within its original context. Cool as fabric and sumptuary law, like Mir uses stuff that we can learn from in her world. It's not arbitrary. So when we get this description of the key ring itself, it's really quite interesting to me because this is probably something that was made at the time that the building was made. So we can look at like materials, technologies that might have been simultaneous.
It's interesting that it's iron.
It's iron, but it's also small. Like iron is a very rigid material to be such a small ring, which means it must be fairly fine. To have the flexibility that you could use this open and shut mechanic that's described, it would have to be like somewhere between 10 and 14 gauge at the biggest.
Yeah, it's interesting that it's iron rather than steel, which has been
Yeah.
mentioned a number of times
And steel
previously.
being like much more common for keyrings than iron
And a
because of
little
its
because of that
flexibility.
flexibility, yeah.
This is another scene I've always really loved. Especially this part where like this tension of like Harrow really wants the key ring. Harrow really wants the key ring. But Gideon is like enjoying this moment of like being the one holding it, which is just a fantastic reminder of how young these characters are.
Gideon is very pleased to have something that's her thing.
Yeah, they gave it to me, Harrow.
Yeah.
And then followed quickly by some more. This person is quite young. Nobody asked what it was, which Gideon thought was fairly friggin' dumb. Just
Yeah.
the wording there
But
is
she
what
also didn't ask.
she also didn't ask. Though, mind you, like she's been specifically instructed not to talk.
That's
Like
true.
her initiating a question is direct violation of Harrow's orders. Not to say that she wouldn't gladly do that. I just don't think this is where she'd do that.
So we're introduced to the tenets of the first house and the grief of the king undying. which foregrounds and hints at John's ambivalence about what he's done and what he makes other people do. It kind of seems in context like the grief is the grief about his other lictors dying, but I don't think it is. I think it's his grief about the lictoral process existing at all.
Oh, what? Say more.
John's whole thing in the next book is about navigating his sense of guilt about the things that he did to the earth and to his friends and to Harrow
Yeah.
and to everyone. I mean, obviously, he committed genocide. He blew up his best friend with a nuke. He did
A lot of bad stuff.
the bad stuff.
And he's a bad guy.
But I think, the same ambivalence about lictorhood that brings Kithareia here is haunting John as well. And John is only messing with people's memories and having these weird, inappropriate relationships because he is so racked by this guilt. And he cannot stand to have anybody look at what he's done. And so I think, the other lictors have been pressuring him, according to Teacher, to call forth new lictors, and he's been resisting. He doesn't want more lictors. He understands that, like, this is bad, and you shouldn't do it, and you shouldn't have done it, and we shouldn't have done it. None of this should have happened. And yet he moves forward with it anyway, which is also the only way anybody becomes a lictor, other than Ianthe, who does just want to do it because she is a monster.
Because she is a monster. I love her so much.
I know you do.
Like realizing how much I love her has been such an eye-opening thing for me, where I'm like, is this, do I want to be the bad lady?
You do. May I draw your attention to your TikTok sound? I'm the monster in the monster kink relationship.
Is that a thing I said on TikTok?
Yes.
I'll have to make a TikTok of me as Ianthe using an audio of my own voice.
I have a TikTok of using that sound as Mercy Morn.
Not only is are we starting to speculate on what John's grief is, but we're also starting to get our first information about what the lictorial process might be. 'Cause we start getting our lictor math in here.
The eight adepts and the eight who would later become known as the first Cavaliers hear that they ascended, and the original eight, what was it? Joined with, again, it's that same language of like joined with their Cavaliers, which sure sounds like they have a plus one, but of course that's not the sense in which they are joined. The phrasing in this explanation that the lictors have spread John's assumption across the blackness of space is a weird phrasing. I kind of assume that this is a reference to like the assumption in Catholicism, but
Same.
I don't actually understand exactly what that would mean. The assumption of Mary is her ascent body and soul into heaven. So spreading his assumption across the blackness of space, what is that even claiming?
Claiming that he's ascended to be God.
Yeah.
Because, like, the lictors are going as these super fucking. Like have never existed before, super powered things coming through. I don't know if it was space empires at that point, but going through the population saying, hey, God's real and we're not dead and we'll never be dead. Just follow this God that's for sure definitely really a guy, but who's definitely also not a guy.
I kind of think that maybe it's kind of a reference to making stuff into Thanergy planets, that it's literally the spread of his power across the galaxies or the universe by
Yep.
taking up space into the way that he does stuff.
Yeah, if by assumption is referring to the process of lictorhood or the process of thanergic conversion.
It makes my stomach uneasy.
Yeah, as it should. It involves genocide, I'm pretty sure. I think that like assumption being a word that captures both the simplest thing, which is like the simplest thing is being is probably this Mary reference. That is probably the simplest interpretation. And then we have one on top of that, which is the necromantic processes that he is extending his power through. And then we just have the assumption that he is God, that this has made him God. His capacity to do this has just inherently made him God. Like they can all simultaneously exist for sure.
Yeah. Peter really frames the attempt to become a lictor as terrible
Yeah.
and tells them that they might die of it.
But doesn't really dwell on that,
No.
just very simply states it, but does dwell on that there's really high expectations here and you can fail.
There's a real sense that, like, nobody's going to be mad if you fail or refuse, though.
Yeah.
I really get the sense of, like, this is meant to be voluntary and it is going to be hard and it's going to be extremely risky and awful, and you don't, like, actually have to.
So we're having this setup leading to what will be like a really heavy hitting twist at the end of the chapter, where we're literally watching skeletons shove off their shuttles off of the edge of the loading bay, and they have no means to leave Kanan House. So when teacher is saying that you ha this is voluntary, trying to frame it as there being choice here, is teacher knowing that within hours that is going to be not true.
I think that there's a distinction between you have to try to be a lictor and you have to be here. Because he's very upfront as he lays out the rules. The rules are you can use any room that's not assigned to someone else. You may not have any contact with the outside world, including you can't leave until either we send you home or you have completed your task. And never open a locked door without permission. And so he does say, like, there will be no visitors. You cannot send any letters out. You cannot use a communications device. And you can't leave until we're done here. But there seems to be a distinction between, like, the project, you're all locked in, but you don't have to be a lictor. And I think that distinction is supposed to be real.
So, I want to circle back to talking about the economy of life and like the value of life here. So, teacher doesn't get to choose his existence. He's just operating. This is where he is. This is what he does. But he can recognize that agency is valuable and worth protecting and emphasizing. The motivation for doing so is because he knows the reality of what they're about to go under, which includes essentially losing a lot of their agency in creating a very specific type of relationship with the God Emperor. And he's like, this is your last chance to back out and have a life.
Well, and it's really strongly implied in this book that all of the original lictors did become lictors voluntarily, which we later learn is less true than it seems on the surface. But it seems like that's the model that's supposed to be true.
So if we're operating that this is still an extension of this scientist cult, to make that the model that's supposed to be true, you do have to shove the shuttles off. You have to say, okay, well, you don't have to do this, but you're never allowed to leave. You have to make a certain set of circumstances where that makes sense. And like teacher having to protect the secrets of this larger reality that this particular ritual is operating within is a justified reason for him to be like, yeah, I'll be nice. Like you're stuck here forever, but you can just like hang out here and I'll make you tea for the next range of your natural life because you're not going to be a lictor and that's fine too. That's literally what that is what he is aware of that he is presenting.
Yeah, he doesn't tell them that they will be allowed to leave. He just says that they can't leave until the priests send them home or until they succeed.
Yeah, and given the priest's mandate to pr protect the secrets of the emperor, I don't think they get sent. I don't think sending them home was ever part of the plan.
Weird to just steal all the heirs of all the houses.
Weird.
seems like John is trying to destabilize his own empire a little bit.
Or at the same time, trying to regain control over it after he has lost control already.
That's what I mean. It seems like he's trying to simultaneously destabilize all of the houses, which could help him then.
Right, by taking away their leadership and putting them as super powered necromancers under his direction.
John has engineered eight simultaneous succession crises.
Yes, he has.
And it seems like he wouldn't do that without wanting to.
Yeah, given that he's resisted to doing it for at least 1,000 years, let's just say.
And there's no reason that they have to be the heirs of the houses. He just needs them to be necromancers.
Yeah, I could see the reasoning around it being that there's a certain type of base knowledge required to engage with the research towards lictorhood that might be preserved within the houses. And so they're maintaining at least the latent capacity to engage with the lictorhood process. And it's him distributing the knowledge of the process amongst the houses.
That he's just kind of okay. Yeah. I was wondering if maybe it was that he thought that the royal families were likely to be very loyal to him.
Given the fact that the necromantic styles is distinct between the different houses, I think it's actually a way of organizing the information that and the knowledge.
That you need to have it, you need to have contributions from each house to get to the right answer.
I think that makes the most sense, just given like the way that we're presented with the lab and like the research in the second book, and we have all these different types of specialists.
What if the firstborn adept in a house was just kind of bad at necromancy?
I mean, then, like, what makes you good at necromancy?
Oh no.
I mean, isn't Corona bad at necromancy?
Corona is bad at necromancy.
So that kind of answers that question, is you fake it.
That's true.
At least that's the answer that the third has to that question.
Yeah.
I think the answers that the other houses might have to that question is different.
That's true. And we don't actually know how good some of the people are at necromancy. We don't know how good Silas is. We don't really know how good Isaac is.
You don't know how good Judith is.
Yeah.
We see some
Yeah.
very limited, like we see some of Judith's necromancy, but we don't really ever see her extend her necromancy.
Yeah. We know that she does stuff. We know that all of them can do stuff, but we don't know. Like, we know specifically that Abigail is extremely good at what she does. We know that Palamedes is really good. We know that Harrow is really good. We don't know that everyone is also exceptional.
We do know that the different houses have different priorities, and their where they prioritize their time and training is going to be an extension of that. So,
Yeah, for sure.
Judith's necromancy having to do with military efforts, but like more strategic level, tactical, higher stuff, while Isaac's necromancy, right? Because Jean Marie is the cavalier. So Isaac's necromancy is going to be more about like boots on the ground, frontline combat, confrontation, logistics, infrastructure. Like we're going to see trends of it applying to what those houses are expected to be responsible for.
Yeah.
So those kinds of necromancy aren't really going to be relevant within the process that's going on here. Not a lot.
Yeah, a little bit here and there. So Gideon, possibly influenced by fiction, has a very specific image of what she thinks that this process is going to be like. And she really projects that onto everybody. She thinks that everybody is expecting skeleton analysis, history of some blood, tomb studies, double bones with Dr. Skellabones.
I feel like I've actually been somewhere that had Swords 2 and maybe Swords 3 listed on a schedule.
That sounds true. I bet you have been somewhere like that.
I am apparently a living stereotype. I think it's funny that when the tone shifts in the room, we still go back to the joke. And you still get more of this like Everyone's really uncomfortable.
And Gideon assumes that everyone had exactly the same idea of what was going to happen that she had, which I don't think is likely. But everybody is weirded out. Everybody maybe does wish that they had a little more guidance and a little more information.
Yeah, they're like, please, please bring out Dr. Skellabone. Where is Dr. Skellabone? The way that teacher explains it is like he picks up on this. He's like, yeah, you outrank me. Like, you automatically already outrank me. I'm not here to tell you what you should know.
Like, I don't know how to be a lictor.
This is my job. My job is to stand here and make you tea.
This is the
Like,
place where people figure out how to be a lictor. Great news. It's the only place anybody's ever figured it out. Anyway, have a great time.
yeah. So hopefully it's got what you need to figure it out.
I feel like this moment of realizing that there's no guidance and kind of wishing that you could just take a classroom study is extremely relatable as a PhD student who has moved out of the classroom era. I am no longer in the part of a PhD where I am in the classroom. I am in the part of the PhD where there are no longer people who can teach me the thing that I need to know because nobody knows it. And that is a scary feeling.
Now, different from the precipice of lictorhood,
I'm not
you
going to murder anyone as part of my PhD. Let me just say that. Like, if there are any murders that happen in my PhD process, it won't be me murdering someone and eating them. I can guarantee you that. I think it's interesting that the skeletons have glowing red eyes.
was a fun detail.
The original ones did too. Like the skeletons on the ninth also have glowing red eyes, which I feel like is such a silly Halloween prop detail to put in.
Yeah. It gives like this is a meme reference vibes. Like I'm like, what anime are we talking about here? Like but it's like a very old visual gimmick with an animated skeleton. Like this isn't like a new idea, but it's very campy.
It's very campy. It really just reminds me of like Halloween store,
Sure.
of just of prop skeleton, like decorated in little red light bulb eyes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because they glow too. They light up in the dark.
And they're like a little bit they get the impression they're a little bit irregular. They're a little bit goofy. Just funny imagining just like in Canaan House, Gideon like getting up looking for a bathroom and just like seeing like a floating red light just walk by. Like this would be a thing that you might be just totally used to if you grew up on the ninth, but that would be just deeply unsettling if you didn't grow up around dark hallways and animated skellies. I wonder if there is status associated to having living versus animated attendance.
I bet there is.
That seems like a third thing.
I was just gonna say, I bet the third has like actual human servants.
Yeah. Just imagining the like, the first was like, there's going to be an issue with the third. We don't know what it's going to be, but they're going to bring too many people with them. We don't know who they're going to bring with, but they're going to bring too many people with them because they keep doing stuff with living people.
That would also suggest that the third is not having the same kind of population crisis because having, a thriving service economy requires having more working people than you actually need for things like sustenance manufacture.
Yeah. We get this kind of decompression moment where, no one's talking to each other and Gideon's kind of just noticing the space, the vibes. Now having time to notice outside. Like, though they were in, to my understanding, a room with a vaulted glass ceiling, Gideon hasn't noticed the sun setting. Gideon noticed this blinding daylight, and now the lights are broken. A conspicuous absence of noticing sunset, despite there being a vaulted glass ceiling above. That's kind of weird. This is a weird day.
It might be summer on Earth, if this is in fact Earth. They might have arrived after dinner. Coordinating arrival time from multiple different planets through super fast space travel would be just a pain in the ass as a host.
Yeah, it would be.
Imagine landing and you're like, well, an hour ago I got out of bed and now it is nighttime. One person's just super jet lagged the next morning.
Yeah, that's so real. We're in a fantasy world where jet lag doesn't exist, apparently.
Well, we don't know because, we don't see that much of people. But Gideon is confused about why it's dark, and Harrow is a little nasty about it.
Description is so good of Harrow's face. It's just such a Harrow face. Eyes glittering like beetles and mouth puckered up like a cat's asshole.
Gideon knows what a cat's asshole looks like.
Gideon knows what a cat's asshole looks like.
There was a previous mention of barking animals, so maybe there's pets on the ninth.
They are an agricultural community, so like the odds of mice not getting in are low. Like, we've managed to contaminate every place that we've developed agricultural colonies. The idea that this is an exception would be hard to believe. Though, like, space travel is often highly sanitized.
I was gonna say, I bet mice would figure out space travel, and then I realized that that sounded like what I meant was, I bet mice could figure out astrophysics, and what I actually meant was, I bet mice could get on a ship.
See, but we could consider Douglas Adams, a world in which mice do figure out space travel and mice are actually super technologically advanced space aliens.
True. Gideon is experiencing a diurnal sleep-wake cycle and is very confused about it. She's like, the lights went off and now I'm all tired. What's happening?
We get like a very, very clear, establishment of what's expected to be the relationship between an adept and their cavalier, which tells us what might have been normal 10,000 years ago. Still a bit weird.
The cavalier's bed at the foot of the necromancer's bed.
Yeah, weird vibe, because we have a few different examples. Like, we could have that as like a bodyguard, so someone who's in immediate danger. We have that as someone who's a personal attendant to like more intimate needs, like, that might be around sleeping. Or we have it as someone who's like, symbolically subservient.
Yeah, it is a very sort of debased position in symbolic terms. Being at the foot of the bed is sort of being hierarchically beneath the body of the adept. And when you think of the friend who sleeps at the foot of your bed, you usually mean your dog or your cat. Like this is, it's a very hierarchized sort of gesture. And Gideon is not having it.
I do love the phrasing. It's one of those things where Casimir's colloquialisms as a fan fiction writer, like having just styles of wording more widely open to her than more conventional fiction kind of allows, like, could not have noped at harder. Like, she's able to use this language that again is telling us a number of things about Gideon. Like, it's a very quick response. She's using this language of noping at something which is associated with like youthfulness, I guess. Like, it's a young way of expressing a feeling. Though, mind you, like, as someone who also nopes at things and I'm not young, I do think that's kind of what it means in context, but like, there's a casualness to that language that really, to me, like, is an artifact of that fan fiction writing. It's the kind of thing you'd say in a text message. So she goes and sets herself up on a massive musty bedding and pillows in front of a huge window in the next room. And like, I've had many a great sleep on piles of bedding and pillows.
Not me. I'm a total princess.
You'd pick the bed at the foot of the adept.
Yeah, I
Okay, well, we are two different creatures. Just like the having a window, I'd be like, bitch, why? No, I want a window. Like, there's a sky here. I want to look at it.
I might take the whole mattress.
Yeah, I could see you doing that. Just or like dragging it loudly just
Just the
to annoy
whole bed.
Harrow.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that. I could see that.
And I think if Gideon wasn't probably quite tired,
Yeah,
Gideon
she
might
is
have
very
done so.
tired. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, Gideon with lots of energy and a need to antagonize Harrow would happily drag that bed anywhere around their wing. But our baby is tuckered out.
Yeah. And I can't imagine she's given a luxurious mattress at the monastery.
No.
Meanwhile, I have a very luxurious mattress and don't even like to sleep in hotels. Musty bedding and musty pillows would be rough for me on a
Just
sensory level.
breathing wise.
Just the smell, it would be hard to settle into a super musty bed.
Sure. Yeah, I slept like on like 6 inches of foam on a tile floor last night.
Can't relate.
I imagine Hera could sleep on a pile of musty bedding, no problem.
No problem. Yeah, I don't think she would notice or care.
I actually think like a highly comfortable bed nest thing would be a bit weird for Harrow. I don't know. I'm trying to imagine what her like sleeping preferences would be. Like I imagine them being extremely simple.
I'm going to say multiple days a week, she just kind of passes out on top of whatever she's reading.
And they're both like winding down and like turning, and you know the narrative focus is turning inward, is separating. We're having this like very end of the day thing. And then this final experience of Gideon's that after she is completely separated from Harrow for the rest of the day, her and her implicitly her alone witness something really quite interesting. And Gideon has no notable reaction besides falling asleep.
Yeah, she sees these shuttles being dropped off the edge of the landing platform, and she is paralyzed by the sight of it, which makes sense because this is the most phenomenal waste she's ever seen. And also, shuttles have up till this point represented freedom for her, so this would be symbolically challenging, I imagine. But once she sees it and registers what's happened, she's like, and just goes to sleep.
And I think this is that duality that I was talking about in Gideon, in our previous episode, where she's able to totally commit to the bit, but also like hold this emotional reservation. And there's a kind of like disconnect that she's able to do to be in these highly traumatic environments, where she just loses her agency so quickly and so thoroughly. She already has an emotional adaptive mechanism for this kind of bullshit, as escalated as this is.
Yeah.
But it is really like a heavyweight dropping into the stomach, and is our first clue that teacher is not entirely forthright.
Yeah, because he didn't say, we're about to drop all these into the sea and you will not be able to leave. He said, you aren't allowed to leave, which maybe for teacher is equivalent because he's not allowed to leave either, but would certainly be more alarming to his guests.
And I'm imagining this like, you know, the edges of them like highlighted by the moon and like this metal versus like algae covered marble, and very could be very visually striking.
It's interesting that they push them off with skeletons rather than having them remote pilot into the sea or something, because it would certainly be sort of on some level less suspicious to have them just take off again, even if they did in fact have them take off and then fly into the sea.
I think this is because they can't actually have communication here. I think they're beyond the ability to be remote piloted.
But they were remote piloted here.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, that is really weird.
Right? Narratively, it gives us a clue that like it was definitely the skeletons that did it. It was not an accident. It was the priests who organized this, but on a sort of meta narrative level, it's like, why'd you do it that way? You had perfectly good robot pilots.
And it is incredibly wasteful, no matter what reason was for doing so.
Eight fully functional spacecraft.
Pew! Psh.
You couldn't have hidden them. You couldn't have put them in a cave somewhere. There was nowhere else on Earth they could have just been hanging out.
Really dramatic choice.
Very dramatic choice. And I think it does highlight, as you said, that This squad was never meant to leave except as lictors.
There's a kind of permanence that is like signed in blood now.
Nunpod with Left Grief is created by Claire Beans and Han Cayley and edited by Han Cayley. Our music is Only Human by Philip Ayers. Today's cover art is by Lauren Wendell. Visit us at nunpod.com. That's NUNPOD.com. Thanks for listening.